Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research, so exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I'm really wanting is for you to get your exercise information from the research experts. And indeed, today I bring to you Associate Professor Chris Fry from the University of Kentucky. He's an expert on muscle, specifically muscle size. So what regulates the increases in muscle size, so muscle hypertrophy, with resistance training, and also what happens with muscle atrophy, so when you're losing muscle size in response to either an injury or aging. So he's done a lot of research looking at the effect of joint injuries on muscle strength and size. So what he's done a lot of studies on is the effect of ACL injuries, so anterior cruciate ligament injuries, and how they cause reductions in muscle size and strength. And interestingly, it looks like it's not just the inactivity that occurs after injury, but there's something specifically going on to cause the loss of muscle size, and there might be changes in the muscle itself, which caused the reduction in muscle size. So that was very interesting. We also talked about with aging, how you tend to lose muscle size and strength, and how part of that is inactivity, but also there may be effects within the muscle itself. And one thing I wasn't aware of that I found very interesting was that what can happen with age is you get a reduction in your muscle's capillaries, so how many blood vessels there are in the muscle. And if you remain active, you can keep the number of blood vessels up. And in response to that, if you do resistance training, you can adapt better. So I was not aware of the fact that if you increase your capillaries in muscle, you can actually increase your response to strength training. So that was very interesting. So I found the whole thing very interesting, very easy to listen to, pleasant manner, etc. I enjoyed it. I think you will too. So stick around. Now, if you'd like to do me a favor and also help get the word out about Inside Exercise, please like, subscribe, and leave comments, etc., because then the algorithm tends to respond better when people search for something they're more likely to suggest Inside Exercise. And as usual, to get the full context, it's better if you listen or watch the whole podcast, but you can actually skip around a little bit if you want to. So there are timestamps in the notes. So you can, if you're on YouTube, you can click on the time indicated and it will move to that section. Or on the other platforms, you can just see the time and move to that section. Okay, so I hope you enjoy the chat with Chris Fry. Hi, Chris. How are you? Welcome to Inside Exercise. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Glenn. Excited to be here today.
That's great. I'm excited too. Nice pictures in the background. I'm sure we'll talk about a lot of stuff related to that. Yes, we're going to be talking about muscle recovery after joint injury. So I guess there's a lot there, I'm going to be interested in bone injury. You'll see. I'll talk about some of my famous bone breaks I've had. So bones, joints, how severe is it? What happens after the injury? What if it's acute, chronic? What if the injury requires surgery? A whole bunch of stuff here that we'll talk about. But what I like to do is to start off saying, how did you get into exercise research? Were you, like quite a lot of, well, including me, I guess, we were sort of sports people. And then we thought, oh, hang on, I can do this as a job. Or did you come in the other way? You're a scientist and then you moved into exercise. How'd that happen?
I think the former for sure. I enjoyed playing sports growing up. Exercise always kind of fascinated me, just my own foray into like lifting weights, seeing how we could build muscle, get stronger by putting in work. And I was an undergraduate and I was speaking with some of the graduate students I knew, and I kind of expressed my interest. I really enjoyed the coursework I was taking in molecular biology. And they knew my, passion for exercise, and they recommended some investigators who did research in that area. And one of the names that came up was Blake Rasmussen, who ended up becoming my PhD advisor. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world to be able to study like how muscle is building protein in the context of acute exercise bouts or nutrient ingestion. And so really kind of, grew forth from there. But it was really, kind of like a way to bridge, like you say, my interest in molecular biology and then muscle growth was kind of how I kind of fell into this field.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. So I know Blake, so I've done some stuff with exercise activating AMPK and things like that. And I remember he was doing some of that. We had a chat at a conference. But yeah, looking through your papers, a whole bunch with Blake. Now, where was that at? And then where did you go? I know you went onwards from there.
Yeah. And so I did my graduate training with Blake at the University of Texas Medical Branch. Afterwards, I found my way to Kentucky for a postdoc fellowship with Charlotte Peterson, looking at satellite cells, muscle hypertrophy, and sarcopenia. I really wanted to kind of expand my training into using some genetically modified mice, primary cell culture, things of that nature to kind of complement the more human-centric training from my graduate research. And after that, it just so happened I was offered an opportunity to go back to Texas to continue working with Blake and his department at the University of Texas Medical Branch. So that's where I, started my lab back in 2014. And then it so happened I was offered an opportunity to come back to Kentucky in 2019. And I jumped at the opportunity just to be able to work with John McCarthy, Esther DuPont, some of the other scientists here at our Center for Muscle Biology. It seemed like just a great opportunity to get back working with scientists, I cherish and collaborators I was really working heavily with, including a lot of the work on, joint injury with Brian Noren. And so that's kind of how I found my way back to Kentucky in 2019.
Yeah, right. And people may have seen that the previous podcast I'm about to upload was Kevin Morag. And I know you've worked together and he worked with Charlotte Peterson as well. So it's a nice little, I don't always plan it, but it quite often it ends up, there's a bit of a sort of a run of similar topics, and then we sort of move on, which is good. All right. So, well, actually, now I think about it, it's because both of you were recommended a couple of times on Twitter by the same couple of people. And it's, that makes sense now. All right. So now what I was saying to you just before we came on is, when we talk about joint injury, I was sort of thinking of these sort of catastrophic, injury. And I was literally thinking about, how does muscle recover after a joint injury that requires surgery? But, I saw while reading your stuff that, we're not even talking about these catastrophic, a lot of your stuff is ACL. So maybe why don't you just talk about that? Because ACL injuries, maybe explain what ACL is as well. But, sometimes people don't even know they've got them, but you have all these effects, yeah? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. No, yeah. And much of what we're doing is not, as you say, more kind of traumatic injuries. It's very kind of sport related, focusing on the ACL. So this is your anterior cruciate ligament. It's one of the two primary ligaments in the knee that really help stabilize the joint. If you're playing, really kind of explosive dynamic sports, soccer, football, volleyball, basketball, that ability to kind of pivot quickly, jump, land, explode back up, that kind of stability around that knee joint is crucial. And a lot of times it's one of the, it's a very commonly injured common non-contact injury. If you're landing in an excessive knee extension, you place a lot of strain on that ligament, it can rupture. You tend to lose a lot of stability around that joint. And so for athletes looking to return to a higher level of competition, they often turn to surgery to try and restore stability to that joint. But even in the absence of surgery, you can still suffer from weakness and other kind of consequences that, affect your ability to complete ADLs, participate in exercise, go back to the level of activity you were, prior to the injury.
Okay. All right. So, because I know, as I said, sometimes people will hurt their ACL and then they'll say, it'll be like, okay, if you're doing a sport where you need to continuously turn and pivot and, jump and basketball and things like that, you need to have surgery if you want to continue at a high level. But if you want to discontinue playing sport, or if you're just running in a straight line, like a distance runner or something, you don't even have to have surgery. Is that correct? Or is that, because that's the impression I have. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously a decision that, an individual person makes with their healthcare provider about what their outcomes are, what do they look to return to after that injury. And so I think a lot of that will help dictate their clinical path forward. But yeah, there are instances where a more conservative management can be appropriate. The ACL is often not injured in isolation. There's often concomitant meniscal damage or injuries to other aspects of the knee that may then make surgery more beneficial to try and kind of restore the breadth of the problem that could have occurred. So, it's tough to make like a one size fits all recommendation. Yeah. But yeah, it can be complicated as to how to then best proceed, if you have sustained this injury.
Actually, I was just thinking, I was going to continue on, but I was just thinking of something. So you know how if you have a joint injury, you have more likelihood of getting arthritis and things later in life. Is that only if you open that up? So if you've done a joint injury, like an ACL, and you don't have surgery, do you have a greater likelihood of getting arthritis in that knee? Or is it only, because my feeling was it's when you open it up and you dick around in there. I probably shouldn't say that, but when you open up and do surgery, that you have that increase, or do you know, is that,
No, point taken. I appreciate the wording too. Yeah. There's pretty clear data that even, in the absence of reconstructive surgery, you are at an elevated risk of developing, post-traumatic osteoarthritis in that knee, just, having sustained the ligament injury itself.
Okay.
number of factors can contribute to that, but yeah, it definitely can predispose you to kind of like poor long-term health outcome.
Well, that's interesting. All right. So that's the thing I'm really interested in, is that the fact that you can injure your ACL, and even if you don't have surgery and you're just walking around and you're not even inactive, because that's the thing I always think about, and you'd know from, because I know you've seen a few podcasts, I'm often saying, well, how much of it is the inactivity? So, you know, we might talk about aging later, which I meant to say at the start. You've done a lot of research on that with muscle hypertrophy. You know, it's always like, well, you're getting weaker with age. How much of it is the inactivity? How much is it? Is the aging process. So I was just kind of assuming when you do your ACL, for example, and you have problems with the muscle, it would be because of the inactivity. So I wonder if we could talk about that. And let's start talking about what does actually happen. So you hurt your ACL. Just say I hurt my ACL today and I decide not to do any surgery or whatever. And I'm walking around. I'm like, what do I care? You know, I'm just a cyclist at the moment. What actually happens? What happens to the muscle?
No, it's a great question. You know, I think that's one of the more compelling questions that I have interest in, is how to kind of like parse out the relative contributions from like a disuse or reduced activity, you know, versus the injury itself. And it's one of the harder things experimentally to kind of tease apart, is like, you know, there's still guidelines in place after sustaining this injury. You know, we have a tendency to be more protective of that joint. You're you know, prescribed to be on crutches, braces, things of that nature that facilitate, you know, whatever muscle maladaptation is happening, because you're not using it to the extent you were before. It's you know, there are limitations, but we've tried to kind of parse out some of those respective contributions using some animal models, you know, where we induce an injury to the ACL in rodents, and then we can, you know, control for that aspect by placing some of them in a, you know, unilateral limb immobilization, like a cast, some of them not cast alone, to try and understand the respective contributions of the disuse component, the injury component, and then the kind of combination of the two. And it was actually some of our recent work that showed, you know, disuse via the cast versus the ACL injury itself had about a similar degree of muscle atrophy.
Okay.
And when you took both together, so an animal with the ACL, the experimentally induced injury plus the cast, they had about an additive, you know, not quite synergistic, but it was a statistically elevated, you know, amount of atrophy compared to either the casting or the ACL.
Okay.
So, you know, I definitely don't dismiss, I do feel that inactivity, that relative disuse is critical. Like, you know, is it aging per se that leads to all these changes we see, or is it part of that, you know, decreased activity, much like what you just said? I think disuse contributes to that process, but I don't think it alone can explain the problems we see in muscle.
Okay, all right. Because, yeah, I just for a millisecond, I took it wrongly there. I thought you were saying it was the disuse. So you're saying the disuse has negative effects on muscle. The damaged ACL has negative effects, and if you have both, it's additive.
Yes.
So that sounds like there's two different processes going on there.
And then they may intertwine too. It's one thing we're actively exploring, is how they come together, sort of to you know, really put you in a spot you don't want to be in to try and recover from.
Yeah, it's actually, I'm glad you said that, because it's quite simple sometimes to say, this does A and this does B. So they must be separate. So it's A plus B. But I think, as I think we know in science, things are a little bit more complicated than that.
Agreed.
All right. So if you just hurt your ACL and you're not inactive, so I've hurt my ACL today and I'm like, what do I care? I'll just get on the bike and ride. You're saying I would still be having, well, I guess that's another twist. Because does the exercise then interact? So let's forget that bit for now. So, okay. So if you hurt my ACL, yeah, or you do, it's not all about me, or someone else does, or your mouse does, what actually happens then to the muscle and the joint?
Parsing out through sort of time course collection biopsies, you know, when we can convince a human to undergo repeated muscle biopsies after having sustained this, you know, pretty life-altering injury, we see that, you know, the atrophic processes set in very quickly. One of our more recent studies really kind of showed that it was a decrease in like protein anabolic processes more so than elevated catabolism, and that contributed to that early atrophy. And this was all occurring prior to surgical reconstruction. So,
make sure people are good with those terms? Yeah. So maybe just for some people that don't, what is atrophy? What's hypertrophy, I guess? And then anabolic, catabolic, all that stuff. And then we'll continue on.
No, great stop point. Atrophy is, you know, basically where your muscle gets smaller from where it was before. It loses size. And we were interested in whether it was more the building processes or the breaking down processes. And so we parsed out this difference between anabolism and catabolism. So anabolism is how our body builds muscle. Catabolism is how our body breaks down muscle.
Right.
And one of the more interesting findings from our study was that after the initial ACL injury, we found that it was those muscle building, you know, pathways that were turned off, so to speak, and not as much an increase in the muscle breakdown pathway.
Okay.
So trying to understand, you know, the etiology or how that atrophy occurred, how our muscle gets smaller, at least the evidence we found to this point is it looks like you're really shutting down those muscle building properties after the injury.
That's right. Now it's starting to come back to me when I spoke to Blake Rasmussen, because it was the AMP kinase. So people, if we're people are interested in AMP kinase, they can look earlier at specifically some quite a few podcasts, but talking with Eric Richter about AMP kinase and glucose uptake. But I remember now it was Blake Rasmussen was looking at AMP kinase. And so the idea is when you're exercising, AMP kinase gets activated and it turns on energy producing pathways and turns off energy energy using pathways, which is like protein synthesis. So that rings a bell now. So I was like thinking, how did that fit with Blake Rasmussen? Yes. Now, so you're saying that when you hurt your ACL, for example, you start to lose muscle size, which as you beautifully explained is muscle atrophy. And it was more the breakdown of the, it was more that you reduce the production of new muscle, which is the, actually said, and anabolism, which is the protein synthesis, rather than the protein breakdown. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it seems kind of like semantics at this point arguing, but trying to think about potential therapies, what might be a more useful path forward? Do we try and target those building or the more breakdown, you know, pathways? And this was early steps that we've taken to try and understand where might be, you know, most important to try and target to preserve that early muscle after the injury.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really important. And people, again, can have a look at, we had Stu Phillips on and also Luke Van Loon. And a lot of talk about, you know, when you're increasing muscle size with weight training, for example, is it that you're putting on, you know, more muscle? Is it, or are you stopping the breakdown? So it is very important. And it fits in as well as, do you need, how much protein do you need and all this sort of stuff? So, because it is usually, as you say, it tends to be more the protein synthesis side, yeah, that's been regulated, which is interesting. Because for a while there, I kept thinking, and I know it comes up in the podcast, I kept thinking, it's because it's easier to measure protein synthesis than breakdown, and that people don't sort of think about breakdown as much. But it seems like even though you can measure protein breakdown a little bit better nowadays, is that right? It looks like protein synthesis is more relevant.
Yeah, it's a loaded question. I definitely agree that, like, I think methodologically it was far easier to assess synthesis for a number of years. And, you know, it's kind of the difference has been minimized, being able to assess both breakdown and synthesis these days is much more feasible. I want to say it's pretty context specific, you know, in my opinion, as to whether synthesis or breakdown, you know, dominates that landscape, whether it's building muscle or losing. But yeah, I agree that I do think historically much more emphasis has been placed on the synthetic side of the equation.
Okay. So you're saying you hurt your ACL and you start to lose muscle size, and it's more that it's not that the muscle is getting broken down sort of actively with that protein breakdown sort of process. It's more that you just are stopping synthesizing it because it's turning up. This is the other thing that people may not, you know, muscle's turning over the whole time, right? So you're saying it's turning over, and it's not like you, because it feels like you're losing it, right? It feels like it's just getting, well, you are losing it, but it feels like it's just melting away, right? But it's not actually melting away. It's just not being produced as quickly. Yeah.
That's exactly right. No, I couldn't agree more. You're constantly, it's not, you know, like a light switch on, light switch off. These processes are always occurring, and it's whether you're favoring one side or the other more so as to whether you're actively building muscle or losing, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah. Now, how quick is this? So you hurt your ACL, and, you know, I'm really interested in what's going on, because, you know, what's the signal and all that stuff. We'll probably get to that, but how quick is this happening? And I guess why, I still don't get why, like, why is, if you're not inactive, How does that help you to survive? You know, I always go back to the basic, you know, how does it help you to survive and reproduce? You've hurt your ACL. What is the logic in losing muscle? You know?
No, it's a great question. I'll kind of take it piece by piece. You know, at least with that particular study, we really tried to, you know, recruit participants who had suffered the injury pretty, you know, recently. Even within, you know, I think the 2 to 3 weeks we could get them in to take the muscle biopsies, they were still looking at about a 10 to 15% loss in the size of their muscle fiber. So not as substantial as, you know, putting someone in bed for a month, but a meaningful degree of atrophy in my mind. I definitely wouldn't want to, you know, just walk away from 10% of my muscle size. Why, you say, you know, why might these processes be in place? This is just a little bit of, you know, my own interpretation, but I'd like to think that, you know, looking back from an evolutionary perspective, if, you know, you sustain this injury running from, let's say a saber-toothed tiger or something, you know, you're losing stability around that knee. Let's say you escape the tiger and hobble off into a cave. You know, the body has some reparative mechanisms. If it's not a complete, you know, rupture of the ACL, it can heal itself, but you want to kind of protect the joint while it's undergoing those processes. So my thought is that this may be some sort of, you know, protective mechanism where the body is weakening that surrounding musculature so as you're not to overwork that joint while ligaments and whatnot are trying to heal. Makes sense. The advent of, you know, maybe modern reconstructive surgery, are those processes more problematic now than beneficial, I think is where we kind of are thinking about how to better rehabilitate, you know, patients after this injury. But I'd like to think there may be, you know, an underlying purpose as to why that occurs. And it's at least the best I can come up with.
No, I think that makes sense. So how does the body even know? I guess there's all these receptors and all that in there. So there's pain receptors and there's pressure receptors and there's temperature receptors and all this sort of stuff. So the body somehow knows it's hurt its ACL. Because is it right? Sometimes it doesn't even hurt.
You know, I think there can be instances where, you know, the pain is not as severe as others. I think in certain instances, you often are accompanied by, you know, a pretty impactful coming together, if you will, the femur and tibia leading to like a bone bruise or something. And these can be pretty painful events, but it probably depends a fair bit on the exact positioning of the knee when the injury occurred as to how much discomfort was felt in that moment. But, you know, I guess avoiding the use of like absolutes, I'd assume most would experience a fair level of discomfort at some point or another after sustaining the injury.
All right. And then there's, yeah, I'm getting kind of caught up on this for some reason. But yeah, it just does my head in a bit. You can probably tell that this is something that it's not necessarily this catastrophic sort of business. Right. So, all right. So then what starts happening? So I saw you've got there's various signals and things. So what do you think is the signal that's sending to the muscle? I'm talking about the not the inactivity side of it, because you've already said, you know, explained really clearly that there's the inactivity. I think most people can understand if you're not being as active, you're going to lose muscle, right? Use it or lose it. But the bit that really interests me is intriguing is, you know, what's going on that's unrelated to the inactivity, or as you say, it might be, you know, intertwined, but is there a signal? Is it something being released from the injured joint? Is there, you know, is it a systemic thing, hormones, or, you know, what do you think's going on there?
Oh, that's a great question. I think there's a number of bodies of thought as to, you know, what some of those early inhibitory signals are. You know, there's entire, you know, terminology like arthrogenic muscle inhibition, kind of a fancy way of saying some sort of reflexive signal from the injured joint itself that's looking to inhibit the surrounding muscle to perhaps, you know, preserve the joint after, you know, sustaining this local injury. One of our more recent studies showed that a myokine, myostatin, or growth differentiation factor 8 appears very quickly, both, you know, kind of systemically and in those local, you know, muscle groups affected by the injury. And we thought that this may be an early molecular cue, if you will, you know, kind of setting forth this cascade, you know, whereby the muscle is then preferentially, you know, undergoing atrophy, becoming weaker, you know, and whatnot. And, what the exact nature of that first signal is, I think, is still pretty up for debate, but a very active area of research, because obviously being able to identify that would be critical to kind of parse out where strategies could best be directed.
Okay. So yeah, so myokines are kind of hormones and things that are released from muscle. Myo means muscle. So that's interesting. So you think it's not maybe a signal from the joint? Because this is where it gets weird, right? Because joints don't really have much blood flow. And I guess it depends. And you talk about tendons and ligaments and all this stuff. So you start thinking, okay, so maybe there isn't. So you're thinking there isn't really a signal coming from the joint, and somehow the muscle knows?
You know, it's something that would be secreted by the joint, I think, like you kind of allude to, is probably not of, as substantial, just given, like you say, relative blood flow. It would have to like pass through synovial membranes to affect the surrounding tissues. It's a complicated path, you know, to be something secreted from the joint, you know, to affect the muscle, whether it's some sort of inhibitory, like nervous signal or something that could be, you know, reflexing back up. I think there's other, you know, thoughts, you know, around what the nature of that signal could be. We found myostatin present both within the knee and the muscle itself, whether it's, you know, joint derived affecting the muscle, produced from the muscle. That's a little bit harder to kind of parse out experimentally. But myostatin, in addition to kind of being this brake system, if you will, suppressing muscle growth, promotes, you know, connective tissue synthesis. So the collagens and whatnot, the proteins that, you know, compromise our, that comprise our ligaments and tendons, it can have a very, you know, pro-growth effect on those structures to kind of increase, you know, the synthesis and repair perhaps of those ligaments. And so we approach this kind of from the same sort of evolutionary perspective. Is this some sort of mechanism whereby the joint is trying to, you know, heal perhaps an injured ligament through, you know, production of myostatin, while at the same time it's having kind of a counterproductive effect on muscle itself? Is how we kind of approach that problem, so to speak. But is that, you know, the immediate upstream effector? I think we're trying to parse that out very much ourselves.
Okay. And is this acute and chronic? So if someone's had a, because you were sort of talking about getting people in after ACL injuries as quickly as you can type of thing. What about if you had a chronic injury? Does it sort of settle down? And I guess it depends if you've had, so I guess we haven't talked about surgery, non-surgery and things like that. I don't know if there's a question in there or not.
There's something to discuss for sure. I think you get a resolution of some of the early swelling and issues surrounding that injury within the first few weeks. So I think, you know, some of those factors can change pretty quickly. It's tough, you know, finding cohorts of patients who haven't undergone a surgical repair route to understand the direct timeline of how some of these changes in the muscle resolve or fail to resolve. It's a current limitation with, you know, the patients with whom we're grateful to work these days, in that they are electing to have a surgical reconstruction. So we have kind of limited insight to see what goes wrong early in the muscle, and then we're just kind of unable to see how well that would resolve over time, because at that point, you know, they're moving forward with reconstruction, and then we follow them after surgery as well.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about ACL. Is this something peculiar to ACL? Is it the same if you sprain your ankle or something? You get similar changes in myostatin, similar rates of atrophy and things like that, do you know?
That's a great question. I'm less familiar with, you know, chronic ankle instability, things of that nature, but I know there's tons of fantastic work looking at like rotator cuff injuries, and they see very similar kind of muscle degeneration, protracted atrophy, weakness, this kind of like bad, you know, set of outcomes with muscle that don't seem to respond particularly well to current, you know, standard of care. I think there's a lot of unique aspects in that after a rotator cuff injury, you see this kind of very, very well-defined like fatty degeneration within the muscle, whereas, you know, we tend not to see that as much in quadricep after an ACL. So there's a little bit of a unique aspect, but there may be some shared, you know, pathways kind of like setting off poor outcomes, you know, with various joint type injuries.
Okay. Now we've had people on like Wim Durabe, et cetera, talking about muscle fiber. So fiber type comes up a lot. What tends to happen when you injure yourself with the loss of muscle size? Is it the fast fibers mainly? Is it slow? Maybe we just explain a little bit about fast and slow twitch fibers as well. And then,
Definitely. Yeah. And so at least from like a human muscle standpoint, you can kind of think of three sort of fiber types. On the one end of the spectrum, you have what we tend to refer to as your slow oxidative fibers, your aerobic fibers, your type one. These, you can think of like your marathon muscle fibers. They can produce contractions for a long period of time based on how they produce energy. Kind of in the middle are your fast oxidative fibers, or your 2A, that can produce a lot more force or more powerful. And then they have kind of a mix in how they're producing energy. Is it more aerobic or anaerobic? And then you move into the fastest, your type 2X, that are very anaerobic, if you will, and tend to fatigue very quickly, your sprinter muscle fiber types. And so we tend to see atrophy across all three of these fiber types within the muscle, but it does appear that your 2A fibers are preferentially affected. They undergo the greatest degree of atrophy. And then we'll also see a shift where some of those 2A fibers adopt more of a hybrid fiber type appearance, where they start expressing different versions of that contractile protein, and how that confers, you know, functional disadvantage or just adaptation after the injury is something we're trying to parse out.
That's interesting. So people can also go to Wim Derive's talk about the controversy about how many 2X fibers there actually are in humans and all that stuff. But that's probably beyond the scope right now. Okay, so people are probably itching to know, and I am as well, what we can do about this. So you've done your joint injury, and then you start to atrophy. Naturally, you'd say, well, just start doing weight training. But I guess if you've got an injury, you've got to be careful. So what should people do? I guess people do things like, you know, isometric contractions and electrical stimulation and all sorts of things. Or just wait. If you're going to have the surgery, just wait till we have the surgery and then get going. What should people be doing, do you think?
Yeah, I feel these are, you know, important conversations to have with your healthcare provider as you kind of plan forth your approach to care. I think there's a fair bit of literature and science to support that patients who go into surgical reconstruction with greater strength deficits. So just comparing the relative strength level between that ACL injured limb and then your kind of opposite limb, the uninjured one, you know, if you have a greater difference between those, you're often failing to meet certain outcome measures after surgery. And so they've argued this may suggest a need for sort of like a prehabilitation, where you undergo some targeted exercises leading into that surgery to try and better prepare the body, or the muscles, at least, you know, surrounding that knee, to bounce back quickly after surgery. I think there's a number of, you know, approaches different groups have taken, looking at, like you said, electrical stimulation. If you're losing the ability to activate that muscle yourself in that initial post-injury or post-surgery period, there are ways to kind of stimulate it to try and keep it firing, to not lose it, you know, so to speak. If you don't use it, you lose it. And this is one of the ways you can kind of continue to work the muscle, even if you're having trouble voluntarily activating it, flexing it, or using it. You can, you know, stimulate it to an ability to try and continue to use while you gain back that ability to control it better.
Yeah. So, and I guess I'm wondering, so if you have surgery, okay, so we're assuming people are having surgery now, yeah, pretty much from now on. Okay. So then you have the surgery and you do resistance training and things afterward. I guess, how quickly do you do it? Do you start? I can't help thinking of, so I've managed to, I used to be a distance runner. I got injured, and then I'm a cyclist, but I pretty much only ride inside now, you know, Swift and Wahoo kickers and all those things, because I just, almost every time I go out, I crash and break something. So I've broken both wrists, my vertebrae. And the big one was neck of femur of my left leg in a bicycle crash. And anyway, so I can't help thinking about that, because I had the surgery, the plates and screws and things put in, and it was within 24 hours they had me doing squats, you know, not you know, heavy squats, but just, you know, with my body weight. And I swear, I literally had a vasovagal where I, you know, like fainted. I swear it was partly because of the pain. But so they get people onto this quickly. Is it the same with the, it seems like it's the same nowadays with pretty much everything. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, you know, coming out of that initial, you know, post-surgical period, different patients can have different degrees of swelling and that ability to kind of, you know, restore early range of motion. There's just some of the early like clearance guidelines to then start, you know, exercising. So they look to see your ability to activate the muscle. Can you perform like a leg raise? How many degrees can you rotate around your knee? And once you meet certain criteria there, you're clear to start progressing.
That sounds nice. Yeah, we didn't do any of that. Let's just get out of bed and start squats.
But I think if you have the ability, ability to use those muscles more quickly is exactly better to keep them. But clearance to be able to engage in those activities, I know, is kind of like taken on a case-by-case basis.
So it's the quicker, generally, obviously, case by case. And I like it that you keep saying it depending on your, you know, provider and all that. So there's not blanket responses. But, you know, assuming the surgery's gone well and things, generally, they try and get people back sooner rather than later.
Correct,
you know,
correct.
The old days of, you know, laying in bed until you feel better and, you know, whatever. You're trying to work the muscle. So I guess that's been shown to be beneficial, yeah. Now, what I'm interested in is because I know it's actually Andy Coggan, who was the first person I had on the podcast. Funnily enough, he had managed to break his – it's not funny. He'd managed to have – because I've known him for years. He told me he had broken his left neck of femur in a bike crash as well, same as me. And he said he was always – because, you know, Andy's switched on guy and he knows – he does the measurements. He said he was like always about 7% weaker and all this sort of stuff. So I'm interested in that because I then got pedals on my bike, which each pedal had – power, and I could see it's like, oh, I don't want to be 7%, and I kept trying to balance it, and I was like, is this even smart? Because if my body wants to be 7% weaker, maybe it knows more than, you know. So I'm trying to like balance it up, and that actually caused another one of my crashes because I kept looking at the power meter all the time. So what I'm getting at, I guess, in a roundabout way, and making it all about me as usual, is do you end up back, or is there still some sort of something going on, you know, because that was always kind of weird to me that, and I think I looked up the literature and it was quite common that, again, sorry, this isn't a joint, it was a bone, but it's near the joint. There seemed to be this thing where you think you'd come back. And I know that a guy called Balocchi was leading the Tour de France and he crashed, broke his neck of femur, and he never came back, you know, and it's sort of like, so do people come back as they were, or is there some sort of inhibitory thing going on?
No, and I think that's one of the more, you know, intriguing aspects of this is I think there's such a variety of outcomes. You know, there are a number of athletes we can all think of, likely a high profile athlete who sustains an ACL injury, but, you know, you see them back to the same level of competition they were before.
Yeah, of course.
I think for every one of them, you know, how many others fail to kind of get back to where they were? Mm. And at least, you know, from a professional sports organization standpoint in the United States, I think looking at like professional football or basketball, there have been some nice studies that show that even three seasons out, you know, there are still deficits in performance amongst players who have undergone reconstruction. So, you know, what separates those that do recover from the ones that fail to? Because there is, you know, some who do come back and, you know, we're just like they were pre-injury, and how to parse that out to better like deliver care. Yeah, it's one of the more fascinating aspects that kind of keeps me, you know, grinding in this field.
Wow, okay. That's interesting because I was thinking like if you're a quarterback or something and you've done your ACL and you come back and you're just as good as you were, I guess there's a lot of factors there, right? You're also a bit older and wiser and, you know, it's not just like, oh, the ACL must be 100% just because you're, you know, throwing the ball as good as you were. But when you actually get them in and measure force and torque and, you know, power and all that, does it tend to be a deficit or again, as an individual, some people come back, some don't. I don't know if you know that.
It's interesting. We've been studying patients, I'd say the last 10 to 15 years. And so many of them are grateful and will come back for follow-up testing. We're really appreciative of that. Mm. And you have kind of these like two groups, you know, those that are, you know, doing very well post-operatively 2 to 10 years out and some that really aren't, and trying to understand, you know, the nature, what separates those two groups, where they'll still show, like you say, you know, maybe it's a 7% or a 10%, 15% deficit, you know, between their legs. Others will be back more close 1-to-1, but how to explain that, you know, so many years later. It's something that we've kind of like started gaining a little bit more interest in, as to how can we better, you know, get those people back to the other group that are more content and performing better post-operatively.
That's really interesting. You sort of wonder if there's some sort of inhibition or something going on that's
exactly.
It may not even be in the muscle. It might be the nerve, the protecting, you know, the central nervous system protecting the area, or some sort of feedback from the joint or something.
Very true.
Yeah. All right. Now what about, as I said, mine was like a bone break, and we've been talking about joint, and it's you know, obviously if you're talking about your neck or femurs, I don't know if people know, but it's, you know, we're talking about, I don't know, 2 inches for the Americans, 5 centimeters from the actual ball and socket joint of the hip. Does it make a difference if it's bone? I don't know if you've looked at bones versus joints. So if someone's broken a bone, do they lose similar rates of atrophy and things? So if they're not using a knee because they've broken a bone versus it's something in the joint, do we know about that?
It's a great question. It's not an area that our lab actively pursues, but I have an interest in that literature myself. But, you know, I think preclinically, you know, the use of sort of like multi-tissue traumatic injuries have shown that if you have a bone break, it's actually interesting that there are certain cells within the muscle that can migrate towards the site of that fracture and then actually help to facilitate callus formation, you know, bring that bone back together. But it's interesting because when, you know, they further challenged that same animal or a different animal with a bone break as well as like a soft tissue injury, an injury to the muscle, you know, the bone reparative process was substantially delayed. So if the muscle is intact, perhaps it can have, you know, a helpful ability to support, you know, the recovery of the bone. Any sort of like multi-tissue component there, you might actually be worse off recovering any one of those individual tissues.
Okay, well, I had no idea about that. So the muscle actually helps the bone to repair. Okay, so I guess, what are they called, osteokines or something? Things that are released from bone.
Exactly. It was a small subset of cells, like a specific type of stem cell in the muscle that really kind of showed that reparative process. A very eloquent study.
Oh, no, sorry, I got it back to front. I'm talking about osteokines. Yeah, so I'm talking about stuff released from bone. So you're talking myokines, again, being released from the muscle to affect the bone. Well, that's interesting. And you could almost imagine that during a bone break, there'd be more stuff released from the bone than from the joint, because, you know, we're talking about the joint doesn't have as much blood flow and things. I mean, bones don't. I think it's more and more recognition that bones aren't just, you know, a piece of chalk you break. You know, there's a lot going on in there, and there is blood flow changes. And even the guy, what's his name again? Hanonen. I think he showed that you get blood flow increases in bone, your exercise and glucose uptake changes in bone and things. So stuff's going on in there. But it's kind of easy to imagine, I guess, if you break a bone, there could be all sorts of stuff released. You know, to sort of, because, you know, part of what goes on is you get cells, what are they called? What's it called when, you know, you have stuff released to then cause other cells to come to the area?
Chemotaxis, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can imagine a lot of stuff going on. But anyway, so essentially, is it maybe not understood as much, but I guess you'd have a similar process going on, that the muscle would start to atrophy.
Right. Yeah, a worse off outcome. You're having to repair multiple tissues at that point. It's going to take a lot more resources from the body to repair. My own fear would be that muscle is more expendable per se, and there may be more compromise to muscle in that recovery process.
All right. So just to go back a bit about what might be going on, the signals and things. So you touched on some, you said myostatin and what was the other one you said? There's a cytokine, another cytokine, I thought you said. It was only myostatin, you said?
We were talking about myostatin, and we talked about some of the protein metabolism changes that occur, but irrespective of any specific hormone per se.
Oh, yeah, okay, sorry, I got that wrong. Okay, so myostatin, and then I saw some papers, you were talking about things like reactive oxygen species, so free radicals and things like that. Did you want to just say a bit about that? And also you found changes in your aerobic capacity of the oxidative capacity of muscle and things like that.
Yeah, no, that's some more recent findings from a former postdoc in the lab, you know, trying to parse out where some of the other deficits might occur and how might we best develop sort of an approach to treat those. And so we had a thought about, you know, exploring some antioxidant therapies. And we saw that after the injury itself, your muscle energy powerhouses, those mitochondria, become less efficient. you know, to help produce energy to sustain the muscle to do its job. And we also saw an accumulation of reactive oxygen species induced damage. And so, you know, in a nutshell, this could be a way that you're modifying proteins or other structures in the muscle so they actually function less efficiently, you know, in the absence of accumulating this damage, and the muscle can become weaker because of that. And so in an effort to try and rescue this, you know, we took a mouse that kind of overexpressed a specific antioxidant to see if that would be protective against some of the issues, the weakness, the atrophy that we observe in both the animals and the humans after this injury. And these little like antioxidant superstar mice were pretty protective against some of that atrophy and weakness. So this isn't the same as taking, you know, an antioxidant orally or some sort of medication. It's definitely a supraphysiologic model, but we thought if that showed some ability to protect or rescue these deficits, it may then open up avenues for different types of antioxidant therapies in an effort to try and look at a different pathway to kind of get patients back to where they want to be sooner.
Okay, all right. And I guess you haven't had a chance because you've just, as you said, that's recent findings. So you haven't had a chance to go on and look at that yet.
We haven't moved it into anything more translationally relevant at this time.
Yeah, another interesting thing I saw is you've got this talking about the mitochondrial oxidative capacity, so the aerobic capacity of the muscle, does not recover with rehabilitation. So that's interesting. So even after rehabilitation, there was still some problems with the muscle's aerobic capacity, or?
Yeah, and that, you know, so I guess one of the more striking findings is that, you know, irrespective of this kind of very intensive, you know, rehabilitative exercise program, you're still seeing some deficits there. So what can we do to better try and like deliver care to rescue some of those problems in the muscle? I come from a very muscle-centric point of view, you know, so diving in to see what all is going wrong in the muscle has been pretty eye-opening and a lot of fun, you know, in a way to try and understand how we might better think about what, you know, rehab looks like per se to try and address some of these deficits that we see likely still remain, you know, through kind of a current standard of care treatment program.
Okay. Now, one thing I've asked a couple of people along the way is this thing, if you injure yourself, you probably don't know, you haven't looked at this, but, you know, should you be taking anti-inflammatories or not? It kind of came up at one stage because, you know, you get swelling and things like that, and that's a natural response. But sometimes, you know, sports medicine doctors and things will say, well, the body kind of exaggerates its response. So, you know, you're better off taking anti-inflammatories. And I think putting it together from people I've spoken to so far, they're saying maybe it's the timing, you know, if you allow, I don't know, a couple of days of normal swelling and then maybe take the anti-inflammatories and whatever. But it seems like it's not that clear. I'm sure you haven't looked at that, but do you have any ideas on that? I'm sure it's beyond the scope. Or have you looked at anything like that, anti-inflammatories or?
It's a great question. I mean, I think about my own kind of like exercise. I definitely feel some wear and tear from time to time, but I'm always really reticent to take, you know, an NSAID or some other anti-inflammatory. I don't want to, you know, perturb those initial inflammatory processes because that's very helpful, you know, to the recovery that we want from exercise to get, you know, to get better, to get bigger, faster, stronger. And so I try and take a similar approach, you know, looking at this post-injury recovery. You do have kind of maybe an elevated, you know, inflammatory state. So there may be, you know, a need to dampen that down a little bit, but titrating it out so where you're not actually like mitigating, you know, a positive effect that you might get from an acute rehab bout or an exercise bout, but trying to control for this, like maybe increase in systemic inflammation, you know, following the injury or surgery. I think parsing out that to know when and how to deliver some sort of anti-inflammatory strategy is key.
Yep, yep. But you probably wouldn't be, because I mean, I get the feeling some people, hopefully not that many, kind of think, oh, every time I'm exercising, I'm doing, you know, some damage and all that, so I should just take anti-inflammatories. It's probably, again, it's not probably either of our areas, but logic would probably suggest let the body do what it does best and sort itself out.
I agree with that.
Yep. All right. Now, I saw you had something here about vitamin D. What was that one? A couple of studies on vitamin D. What were you looking at there and what did you find there?
Yeah, I definitely take a moment. You know, I'm here able to talk about all this because we have a, you know, a very rich multidisciplinary team. You know, my collaborator, chief collaborator in all this work, Brian Noren, you know, brings a ton of orthopedic expertise, physical therapy guidance, and really jumpstarted my own passion in this field. But you know, I can't even take credit for the vitamin D work. That's the work of my very talented wife. She's a registered dietitian who has an interest in recovery after injury herself. And, you know, some of the early, I guess, sessions she had speaking with some of our participants on diet and whatnot after the injury, she noted that some of them would likely appear to be pretty deficient as far as vitamin D goes. And she was interested if that could help explain some of these outcome differences. Were patients who had lower, you know, levels of vitamin D more susceptible to poor outcomes? And that was kind of the basis of her study, was looking to see with a you know, kind of a clinically relevant cut point, how do you recover better or worse if you have less, you know, vitamin D available in the body? And she saw pretty compelling evidence that in those participants who had lower vitamin D levels, they had kind of an exacerbated atrophy response. And, you know, that occurred, I think, through, you know, 4 months postoperatively. So you're completing rehabilitation, you're moving through the process, but you're still doing more poorly than individuals who had,
okay,
I'll say, a more normative amount of vitamin D, either through diet, sunlight exposure, these sorts of things.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I couldn't help noticing the same surname, Fry. And it's interesting because my wife, it sounds like you guys, I couldn't help thinking of my wife and I as well, because she's a dietitian, but she's also done exercise. I met her at Ball State, actually, where Kevin Murat was at. It was last week. Anyway, so she did exercise physiology, and then she did nutrition and dietetics. And I'd say we're a bit of a boring couple, because I'm an exercise physiologist, and I was doing a lot of nutrition related stuff, effective carbohydrate ingestion, carbohydrate loading. And she's a dietitian with an interest in exercise. So it's sort of, but it sounds quite similar to you guys.
Very similar. No, she's got a big interest in exercise science herself, but, you know, kind of classically trained in dietetics and nutrition. But that's a very, very funny story. And yeah, meeting at Ball State's not a bad place to meet. Lots of fantastic scientists hail from Ball State.
Oh, that was great. So, okay, I can't mention Ball State without mentioning, so I've had the legendary David Costa on, so people can have a look at that. And then who took over from David Costa after many, many years of all the fantastic work he did, Scott Trappy. He's also been on, so couldn't help mentioning that. Okay, so I think we've had a good chat. Have we covered everything, do you think? Oh, I did have a little note here about... this is my thing about wondering, is it local or systemic? So are the muscles that are locally affected only, or are there some sort of systemic? Because if you're talking about things being released into the blood and things like that, is there systemic effects? So naturally, if you've hurt your ACL, for example, and you've been inactive, then you'd expect to have, well, based on what you said now, I've learned from you, which is great, you would have more atrophy in the leg you've hurt, because you've got the inactivity plus the effect of the ACL injury. But have you looked at other muscles? Is there sort of any inactivity independent effect on other muscles as well?
Oh, it's a great question. Yeah, this is from one of our recent papers, 2023 in Science Advances. We are always, you know, trying to minimize participant burden, and it'd be great if we could take biopsies from both legs as frequently as we want to, but to try and minimize the poking and prodding they undergo, we can't assess atrophy in that non-involved or uninjured limb, but we do assess its strength kind of throughout the same timeline. We see no changes, both, you know, either gaining strength or losing it in the non-injured limb through 6 months post-operatively. So, you know, and these patients are, you know, doing their best, staying active in rehabilitation. They're not, you know, disuse affecting that uninjured limb. So at least right now, I'd say that there may be systemic effects, but it's not resolving itself to a meaningful deficit in muscle strength in that uninvolved, uninjured limb. You know, I guess the best that our literature shows us right now from the studies we've conducted.
And again, it sort of makes sense if we're thinking about, you know, you're talking about evolutionary, whatever. So you limp off into your cave and everything. But, you know, if another saber-toothed tiger comes, you want the other leg to be able to at least help you hop off. Yeah, it doesn't make sense to lose it in both legs.
This is true.
All right. So we've talked a lot about this, and it's great. And it's very interesting. Just let me see. Do you think we've covered everything?
I think we did a fantastic job. You very, very nicely led the discussion. I was happy to be able to share some of our recent work. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Just from Twitter, before we move on, because I want to talk a bit about aging and muscle hypertrophy and things. Twitter, Alex, how can we reduce the loss of muscle mass and strength after surgery and during a mobilization period? I guess we've talked about that a bit, but is there anything, I guess we've just talked about do resistance training, but you know, how often, how much, is there anything else we can do?
Especially within the context of, you know, disuse in addition to post-injury, that's the million-dollar question, is what can we do to slow these processes? And I think, you know, trying different approaches. I know we've got interest in kind of like a regenerative rehabilitation. There may be some combination of pharmacologic agents in addition to exercise. And that's, you know, a combo that would be more protective against the kind of stern, you know, current approach we have right now. But I wish I had a golden answer right here as to how to slow these processes. But I know whether it's disuse or post-injury, you know, arresting that weakness and muscle loss is of critical importance. And there's a number of researchers actively pursuing that question.
Actually, I meant to say earlier, because a couple of times it's come up with previous people as well, you can't always assume that the muscle size and the muscle strength go hand in hand.
Correct.
So, yeah. So Jeremy Lenneke, especially, we talked about blood flow restriction. You can get some dissociation between the muscle size and the strength, and depending on the type of weight training you do and things like that. So, yeah. So when you hurt your joint, injure your joint, does it sort of go hand in hand, or is it, you know, the loss of muscle size and strength, or does it sort of?
Yeah. We see fairly consistent correlations between the degree of atrophy and the degree of weakness. That's not to say that atrophy is the driving factor there per se, because I do agree in certain instances there can be a dissociation between muscle loss, gain, and then, you know, relative changes in strength. But at least right now, in the data that we've collected in our lab, we see a pretty strong correlation between the degree of atrophy and the degree of weakness a person might undergo.
Okay.
But yeah, definitely not on a, you know, a complete, you know,
and the same with the question. And then the same with the rehabilitation, does it tend to go hand in hand? So okay, well, that's simple. Because yeah, it gets a bit complicated and you're just trying to understand what's going on. Okay, now Dean also, sorry, Dan from Twitter, basically he had a part of his question where he said, sometimes it feels like it's time since trauma is the biggest influence. Bigger influence than strength training itself in regaining strength, is it?
Yeah, I saw this question posted, and it you know, got me thinking a lot too. It's you know, it's one of the things that I'm most interested is how quickly do, you know, these sorts of changes become entrenched and therefore, you know, less able to be acted on to kind of rescue, so to speak. Do you get to a point, if you've waited so long, are you then less able to bounce back? And I, you know, I'm not trying to advise anyone to change dates. I think these are obviously very, very important questions to have with, you know, your clinical provider. But thinking through, you know, when an opportune time might be to have surgery, there's at least, you know, some literature that shows delaying beyond 6 months might be associated with poor outcomes. Obviously, you wanted to wait a few weeks for that early kind of swelling and you know, loss and range of motion to be resolved, you know, prevent like arthrofibrosis or other kind of poor outcomes due to surgery. There's likely, you know, I'm sure an opportune window for everybody. I don't think it's exactly been honed in on per se, and limitations in healthcare systems too. When the injury is sustained, how quickly you're able to see providers to get, you know, the surgery scheduled. There's real world, you know, considerations. Family, work obligations. It's a
expense.
Unfortunately, it's a complicated issue.
Yep. All right. Now, I also like to ask, just before we move on from this particular, do we know, are there sex differences? Is there, have people looked at that, or effective age and things like that?
Yeah, we had a new grant just start about a year and a half ago, specifically meant to parse that out. Is one of the more interesting things, you know, women, females are more susceptible to ACL injury. And then I guess more so what interests me is they're about twofold less likely to kind of return to prior levels of sport or activity.
Okay.
So, you know, showing poor, you know, ability to kind of get back to where I'd assume they want to be. And we're very interested in parsing out some of those sex specific differences. My own take, you know, definitely my opinion is I feel like a lot of the programs, this you know, rehabilitative approach has been viewed as kind of a one size fits all. Studies historically have focused mostly on, you know, male participants to try and dictate what might be best. And does that address, you know, maybe the underlying deficit that could be unique to females, and then maybe, you know, not address some of those problems as well to better rehabilitate them. And that's one of the things, you know, we're really trying to parse out, you know, from a molecular level to a functional to a psychosocial, is what are those determinants, differences between men and women, males and females, and how can we then better hone in on specific, you know, natures between the sexes to then deliver care more appropriately.
Okay, cool. And if people looked at age, or have you looked at age of mice, or people looked at humans or anything?
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's a very common injury. You know, it tends to be associated with high sport participation. So, you know, we're looking at a relatively young audience is the average person with, at least here, greater kind of sport specialization. The injuries are occurring younger and younger. But, you know, I just, the kind of anecdotal evidence we see, you know, some of the older participants we have tend not to recover as well as younger, but we haven't explored age per se as a specific covariate or tried to parse out exactly its contribution to that recovery process.
All right. So we've had a great chat around this response to injury. Now, what about, so your lab also does a lot of work with muscle hypertrophy in the context of aging. So why don't we sort of define what atrophy is. People could probably work out what hypertrophy is, but why don't we just say, what is hypertrophy and what's going on with aging?
Yeah, no, the ability to build muscle, to make the muscle bigger, is an increase in size is hypertrophy. And, you know, as we age, we tend to lose a fair bit of muscle, we get weaker. And so we're very interested in identifying therapies to arrest those processes. How can we promote muscle growth and retention in older adults to, you know, better tackle challenges they face?
Yeah, so I guess in a way it's a similar concept. So obviously it's longer term. So with aging, you tend to slowly lose strength and muscle mass. And with a ACL injury, another injury, you lose it quickly, and then you want to try and get it back or maintain it. So what do you find there? So again, it's the old classic: is it the inactivity? Is it something per se with aging? So what do you think's going on there with the loss of strength and size with aging?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it was some of our recent work, 2019-2020. That's, you know, to your point, this concept of inactivity. We would take older adults through progressive exercise, and obviously you see a good deal of variation. Some people are able to add, you know, a fair bit of muscle during that weightlifting period. Others, the results aren't as spectacular. And what kind of explains that response variation? And we found that, you know, the density of capillaries within the muscle, those little very small blood vessels that deliver oxygen, nutrients, remove waste, how many capillaries you had at the beginning of training really predicted how well you responded to the training. Wow. Those adults that had more capillaries in their muscle tended to accrue more muscle mass during that resistance exercise period.
Wow.
There's been a number of groups, you know, Gianni Parisi, McMaster, and others who have shown a similar phenomenon, trying to understand if this concept of targeting or building density in that capillary bed is a way to kind of boost responsiveness to exercise with age. And it's something that we have, you know, interest in, as well as this, you know, a more fruitful approach to try and restore exercise responsiveness.
Okay. Well, I never heard of that one. So if you have more capillaries in your muscles, you can hypertrophy, put on muscle size more during strength training.
Yes. And I said, you know, I credit a lot to, you know, the Parisi lab. They really kind of put forth some of these early concepts. You know, results from our lab kind of, you know, verified very much what they had shown as well, that if you take older adults and kind of parse them out into two groups, those with a relatively high amount of capillaries and low, you can, you know, predict pretty well how they respond. And I loop back to your initial point on this concept of inactivity. The biggest determinant of that capillary density, like when we took just habitual activity levels, they wore a pedometer and actigraph, And the step count, you know, correlated exceptionally tightly with the capillary density. The more active you are in your, you know, habitual life, you know, the more capillaries you had in your muscle. And so is just getting out, you know, engaging in a little like walking, light aerobic activity, a way to boost that density and then, you know, maybe better respond if you decide to start taking on exercise.
So there's a lot of stuff going, pinging around in my head there, because normally when you think about capillaries in muscle, you know, the best way to increase that is to do endurance type exercise, right?
Correct.
So this is getting weird, eh? Oh, sorry. Yes, I'm just thinking out loud. Okay, so you do endurance type exercise, you get more capillaries in your muscle. And then that makes you more likely to hypertrophy with strength training?
That's at least the data that we've shown and others as well. And I think there's even a nice trial where they took a unique approach where one leg underwent some what they called aerobic preconditioning, I think like unilateral cycling in an effort to bolster that capillary density. The other leg just kind of remained static, maybe hanging off the side of the bike. And then these participants underwent sort of like a dual leg or bilateral exercise program. And the limb that had undergone the aerobic preconditioning, you know, exhibited a greater improvement, I want to say muscle size and strength. And so, you know, building in this concept, like you say, that the best way to improve capillary density is aerobic exercise and maybe a targeted incorporation of that before beginning a resistance training program, you know, could be beneficial.
Wow. Okay. So this, because remember for a while there was always concurrent training is not a good thing, that the endurance messes up your strength and your strength messes up your endurance. And then it feels like, I haven't really looked at the literature, but it feels like, you know, more and more people are saying, no, you can get both. And that's fantastic. And it almost also makes sense because we're us evolutionary biologists, as we've become during this chat, we keep talking about, with evolution. It makes sense that, you know, if you want to help to survive and reproduce, you know, you want to get whatever you can get, right? So, and again, it's specificity in a way, if you're training. But I guess there's complications there. You know, at some point, you know, it depends how much you're doing. If you're doing a little bit of endurance and a little bit of strength, then maybe they help each other. They may not hinder each other. But if you're doing a whole bunch, then, so what about if you're a bodybuilder or a power lifter? Would you be saying, oh, you should do all this endurance exercise to build your capillaries to then increase strength? I mean,
a good question. This particular instance, you know, was more so thinking about like
maintaining
perhaps older adults, you know, where they have a compromised ability to respond to exercise, not per se someone who's, you know, like you say, a young bodybuilder.
Yeah, exactly.
Their muscle
it's
building ability is, you know, untapped. There's no, you know, breaks on that per se. So I think it may be very context dependent. And if you move into like the kind of very extreme athletes on either the aerobic or resistance standpoint, they may not see as much concurrent benefit. But for the average, you know, person,
that's,
we want
really
both
interesting.
Cardiorespiratory, we want the strength improvement. It's
Exactly. Okay. So let's bring it back to aging. So yeah, okay. So you're talking about with aging, you're tending to lose muscle mass. And if you are active aerobically, walking around, maybe doing some cycling and things, then if anything, that would then help your resistance to maintain your muscle mass, which is, so that way you're getting the benefits of the aerobic exercise on your heart function, your cardiovascular function. We know VO2 max is, you know, probably the single best indicator of longevity. And you're also maintaining your muscle mass, so you're less likely to fall over and things like that as well.
That's exactly right. It's at least what, you know, what our work has shown and the work from others. I definitely something, you know, I plan to take in mind as I continue exercising throughout the years.
Wow. Okay. Now, but I did see some papers where it sounds like there is a bit of compromised. So, you know, aging impairs contraction induced human skeletal muscle protein synthesis, skeletal muscle protein anabolic. So that, again, it's the increase in muscle response to resistance exercise, and essential amino acids is delayed with aging. So again, so bringing it back. So is this independent? So, you know, we've been talking, in positive ways about how the muscle can respond when you're aged. But is there some sort of deficit? Is there some sort of anabolic resistance? I think it's a terminology.
You know, you've had a lot of big names on the show that I think have touched on that. And it's a concept that, you know, I was very near and dear to my heart during my graduate training. I definitely feel that there is a good body of evidence to suggest that there is some sort of anabolic resistance to both exercise and perhaps nutrition as we get older. We are less able to reap the benefits to build muscle in response to exercise or ingestion of protein. And, you know, what the exact nature of those cues are, at least my work and the work of dozens of other scientists in the field would suggest that there is a problem there. But I think, you know, again, parsing out, you know, the nature of that problem is still a very active area.
Okay. So I guess okay. So you think the balance is that there is, it's not just the inactivity with aging. There is some sort of less responsiveness to the endurance, the resistance training and, or even the amino acids. So if you infuse amino acids or give them a certain level of amino acids, they don't get as much of a response in the muscle. Is that right?
Yep. True. Yeah. Okay. And I think there was a nice study from, my former advisor, Blake Rasmussen, where they, you know, had an acute nutrition study kind of before and after a progressive exercise program. And I think the older adults, you know, did have better indices of responding to that nutrition intervention in a more positive manner after completion of a 12-week progressive exercise program. So it doesn't, you know, necessarily tease out whether it's aging per se or inactivity, but it did speak to a restorative effect that exercise was able to have to maybe, you know, turn back time a little bit to become more responsive to a meal ingestion or things of that nature.
Okay. So you think if someone's equally active, older person and a younger person, you think there maybe isn't a whole bunch of resistance?
That's my
to
hope.
Response.
That's why I'm getting up and exercising every day.
Yeah, we take more interest as we get older. Yeah. And even if it is, okay, and this is the thing, I don't want people to think, oh, well, there's no use me doing resistance training. I'm 75 years old. There's no use me because I don't respond as well as a young person. I'm assuming we're talking about very small differences here that you know, people can still, because we know that even 90-year-olds can still get hypertrophy, get stronger, et cetera. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. I would never use any of the research to dissuade someone from, you know, beginning to exercise irrespective of their age. I feel whatever age you are, you know, there's always benefits to be had from engaging in exercise, starting a program. You know, I think it's a fantastic way to try and remain active and fight off, you know, that muscle loss and weakness that, you know, can affect everyone.
Okay. And I realized that a couple of the studies I was talking about, they were ones you did ages ago, right? With so have you been doing more? Because I know you've said another area you work on in the lab is this aging and muscle hypertrophy. Did you want to talk about some more of some recent work quickly?
Yeah. It's unpublished at this point, but it's, you know, work that trying to parse out how different parts of the muscle respond to exercise with age and you know, how that can help the quality of the tissue. So our muscle, you know, we tend to think of as these, you know, multinucleated fibers. They're the ones producing force, helping us lift weights, but there's a lot of tissue surrounding those fibers, this sort of connective tissue that really help facilitate that adaptation. And so some of our more interest work or recent work in that field has really tried to parse out how changes in that connective tissue surrounding our muscle fibers, how they respond differently when we're older or younger. And we've been trying to do some targeted work, you know, primarily in preclinical models to see where exactly those differences are occurring and how we can better try and restore some of that non-contractile tissue response to exercise in an effort to better accrue, to build muscle and strength as we get older.
Oh, yeah. So maybe just, do you want to just flesh that out a little bit? Are you running low on time? Are you still okay to go a bit longer here? Or?
Another like 10 or so minutes.
Okay. Do you want to just flesh that out a little bit then? So you're saying with age, for example, you're getting changes in connective tissue that may be affecting your force and strength and things? Or?
Yes. And so, you know, muscle is complicated, how you're transmitting force across the tissue. And one of the key aspects of that is this sort of connective tissue matrix that surrounds the fibers. This is made up of collagens and other proteins that help provide structural integrity to that muscle. You can think of it like scaffolding upon which the muscle is built. It helps kind of maintain the sort of patterning in muscle. It helps dictate how that muscle, you know, senses force and then produces force to like lift weights or move a load. And we found that, you know, changes specifically in that sort of matrix surrounding the fibers occur where it becomes less able to appropriately remodel or turn over, if you will, in response to an exercise stimulus.
Okay.
Our thought is that this may have some sort of like a physical barrier, if you will, that it's like you're constricting the ability of the muscle it surrounds to grow. And this may be another way whereby we tend not to reap as much benefit from exercise as we age. If your muscles, you know, straining to get bigger against a physical force that just can't remodel, is this, you know, somewhat limiting that hypertrophic ability?
Okay. All right. Now that's interesting. So the actual, because the connective tissue is not stretching or not getting bigger, or the fascia around the muscle or something.
Correct.
Like
correct.
Okay. All right. Now I know you've done a lot of satellite cell stuff, so I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, especially as Kevin gave a little prompt in the last chat about that.
No, happy to chat about satellite cells and muscle growth. Now, this was, you know, research I really, you know, undertook during my postdoctoral training. We were trying to understand, you know, the necessity of satellite cells to muscle growth. You know, typically as we start to lift weights or undergo any sort of resistance training, satellite cells or your muscle stem cells become active. They fuse into muscle fibers, and it's thought that this helps facilitate the growth process. As a, you know, a wide body of literature to kind of show this is a very conserved phenomenon. And, you know, we were interested in that ability of the muscle to grow when perhaps those satellite cells are compromised. You know, we see a relative loss in abundance in satellite cells as we get older. Is this another mechanism that could limit the ability to respond to exercise as we age? And so we used some genetic models whereby we depleted those satellite cells from muscle in rodents, and we then subjected rodents to various types of exercise stimuli. Some of these were very much meant to build muscle as quickly as possible. Other these were more like the kind of concurrent training you mentioned before, where it's part resistance, part aerobic. You know, in instances we would see that it did have an effect on the ability of the muscle to grow. You know, the muscle had some ability to grow in the absence of those satellite cells, but longer term growth was compromised. The quality of that muscle, you know, became poorer. It became more scar tissue and fibrotic. And we were trying to parse out what exactly those satellite cells were doing to signal to other cells in muscle to kind of help regulate the health of the tissue, so to speak, to have the most permissive environment to sustain muscle growth.
Okay. Because it was Ben Miller I had on, and I think he was saying, and I think you've got some evidence as well, that you could do pretty well without, you can actually knock them out and do pretty well, yeah? But it's a bit of a controversial or new area.
Right, no, I heard Ben's yeah. You know, discussion. He had a fantastic stuff to say on the topic.
Okay, cool. All right, so we need to wrap up. So it's been great. Thanks for coming on. What I like to do is finish up with, you know, some takeaway messages. What's some takeaways you want people to get from this?
Ooh, yeah, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thanks
yeah,
for
I've enjoyed
the
it.
Show. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, some of the concepts that you touched upon, it's really difficult to kind of dissect the various contributions of disuse or inactivity on whether it be the aging process or post-injury recovery. But I think just kind of focusing on being as active as possible, you know, within reason after an injury or as we age can help offset those deficits. And I do feel that there are unique aspects in that post-injury process that are occurring independently of just, you know, whatever disuse is doing to exacerbate post-injury weakness and atrophy. So it may be like a two-headed approach you need to get to people not be inactive, but I don't think that it explains the entirety of the nature of the problem.
Great. All right. Well, I think it's been really interesting. I've enjoyed having you on. So thanks again for coming on. Actually, it looks like you do a little bit of weight training yourself there.
I try and stay active, you know, practice what you preach.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks again for coming on. I'll see you around. Okay. See you, mate.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
A ton.
Thanks. Bye. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.